Today's podcast is presented by Podgo. Podgo is the easiest way for you to monetize your podcast, providing podcasters with a flat rate for ad space, so you always know how much you get when you include an ad from Podgo. We recently joined as members, and you can too. Apply today to become a member and immediately be connected with advertisers that fit your audience. That's podgo.co at podgo.co.
In the middle of the 20th century in the United States of America, hundreds and hundreds of teenage boys and girls are becoming hopeless dope addicts every year. It's fantastic.
So imagine you're in a scary movie, you feel your heart race, you feel that anxiety, but you can tell yourself, you use that frontal lobe to be able to say, I'm in a movie, I'm okay, I'm sitting down in a chair, this is all right. That's your frontal lobe helping to control the amygdala, that fear center of your brain.
Just like therapy is not the magic wand that fixes everything right away, medications also aren't, in a lot of cases, the magic wand that fixes everything.
Welcome to the Pretty Girl Pill Club. This is a podcast where a couple of extremely unqualified idiots on the internet with whack as hell brain chemistry talk about our whack as hell brain chemistry, among other things. I'm Sophie, joined by my co-host Ronnie.
This is he.
And today we are joined by the hosts of Millennial Mental Health Channel, who, unlike us, are actually qualified. I'm here with Justin Romano and Eddie Carrillo, who have graciously agreed to come on the pod and help us answer your questions that you asked us on Instagram. Our Instagram, if you're unaware, is Pretty Girl Pill Club. And before we hop into the questions, who are you? What are your qualifications?
Oh, Justin, you want to go first?
Sure, yeah, I'll go first. So my name is Justin Romano. I am a third-year psychiatry resident at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. Really like mental health. That's why we do this. We have our own podcast called Millennial Mental Health Channel. That's about it for me. Go for it, Ed.
I'm Eddie Carrillo. I currently live in Oregon near the Portland area. I am recently a licensed professional counselor. Not a lot of people know, but becoming a licensed therapist takes 2 to 3 years after you graduate from grad school of practice. So I recently got my license. I practice out here. I currently work at a partial hospitalization and intensive outpatient eating disorder program. Like Justin, we really enjoy the mental health profession. I think it's something that's not talked about enough, and we really like to try to make it easy to talk about. So we're excited to be here for you guys and try to do our best to answer questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we answer questions all the time that we're not qualified to answer. So.
Zero qualifications whatsoever.
Just a collective almost 50 years of being mentally ill. That is our experience.
That's all right. Lived experience is helpful. Yeah, definitely useful.
Oh yeah. We like to joke about how like we're just complete train wrecks and you know. The working title for this episode before we got you guys to come on was Ask a Train Wreck, but that one doesn't really work now.
I think you should keep it. I actually like that.
Yeah. You know what? I might keep it. I might just keep it. Yeah. And what actually got you interested in mental health? Like, was it personal experience or just a academic interest?
Yeah. That's a good question. I think for me, it goes all the way back to high school. I played football in high school and college. And as I was getting ready to go to college, I had like figured I'd go to college, but didn't really have a plan. Like a lot of things in my life, I kind of just do it. And then we figure it out as we go. So my senior year, I just was like, well, I should probably take anatomy because I'm a football player, so I probably want to be like an athletic trainer or something. And then I hated anatomy. I wasn't good at it. And at the same time, I took psychology and fell in love with the subject. I ended up majoring in it in college. And then I had an internship with the juvenile department here where my school was at, and just kind of fell in love with the idea of being able to help people out who need it at their lowest point and need somebody that can kind of just be there for them and advocate for them.
Yeah. I went to medical school thinking that I wanted to be a surgeon, And the longer I was in medical school, the more I realized I didn't want to be a surgeon. And the more I realized I loved mental health. It was super interesting to me. The patients were fun, interesting, challenging.
Fun is a way to describe us.
Yes. When you meet someone who's like really manic and they're just 1,000 miles a minute and they won't stop talking, it's great. It's like, it's a blast. They're a party. And I realized that, you know, when I was on my psychiatric rotations, I'd go home at the end of the day and I couldn't stop thinking about my patients, and it was in a good way. Like how was I going to help these people? Like how are we going to get these people better? And like, I didn't really feel that on any of my other rotations. So the longer I was in mental health, the more I'm like, yep, I'm sold. This is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That's awesome. All right. So we're just going to hop into the listener questions. Once again, thank you to everybody who submitted a question. These are all like super interesting. And I was stumped on a few of these. So I was like, how about I just make less work for myself and get some people who know what they're talking about to come on. All right. So the first one is, and this is actually one that I get a lot, medication versus therapy. And how do you balance both?
Ooh. Good question. Way to start it. Mm-hmm. I think
these are in no particular order.
Oh, okay. Even better. I think, well, as a therapist, I was just talking about this the other day. I don't know if it's for like lack of cognitive abilities or just like it's not something that my brain cares about too much, but like I know like next to nothing about the medications. Yeah. So thankfully, like where I work, we like work directly with psychiatrists for each patient. So they're each assigned one when they come into our program. But a lot of the time what we talk about in our show, and I think Justin can talk more to it because he's the science-y guy. But we tend to get best results for a lot of things like depression and anxiety when there's medications and therapy working together. When you have somebody who is able to manage the medication and make sure that whatever side effects you're having, or if you have enough, if you need a refill, making sure that they're working the way that they're supposed to. And when you have someone like that, like a primary care physician or a nurse practitioner or a psychiatrist who speaks with your therapist, and the therapist is in charge of like your treatment plan that you come up with when you first start treatment, and making sure that the goals you want and the objectives you're trying to reach are being hit, and then kind of communicating together. So a lot of times best results come from both working together, not just one or the other.
And as a psychiatrist, I recommend that pretty much everyone goes and sees a therapist. Like, there is going to be no harm from doing therapy. It can only benefit you. So I say, like, a lot of people who have like mild symptoms of depression or anxiety, if you don't feel like it's really running your life, but you want a little bit of help, I say start with therapy. But if you feel like it's one of those things that's really getting in the way, it's preventing you from getting out and being social, it's preventing you from doing the things you want to do in life, that might be an indication that medications could help you. But Ed is absolutely right. The combination of medications with therapy is the best treatment that we have right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of the time what we see, and the good thing about like the mental health world and the different professions, is that I think for the most part, I might just be speaking personal experience, but we like each other. So a lot of the times, like for me as a therapist, like my last job or current job, like I'll be working, and if I think my patient or client needs something a little extra, whether it is medication or whatever it is, you know, I can get them in contact with their primary care physician or mention that or make that recommendation. And just like on the other side, like Justin's saying, is he will have a patient who comes in needing help with whatever symptoms they're struggling with, and he'll be the one to say like, well, you know, I can help get you this medication, or we can start on this regimen, but I also think therapy with it will work. So the good thing is, for the most part, I feel like we work together pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's been my experience. Every psychiatrist I've ever had has kind of like also worked with my therapist, and like mm-hmm. they communicate, because I remember a few years ago, because I've had ADHD my whole life. It's very aggressive, and it does like very much control my life. And I had just gotten new insurance, so I went to a new psychiatrist just to kind of be like, hey, here's my, you know, medical records. Let's just pick up where we left off, basically. Mm-hmm. And after like 10 minutes of talking to me, he's like, okay, but what are we going to do about the depression? And I was like, what depression? And then like, And then I just started crying. And then, you know, later that day I was on Zoloft and it was great. And it like changed my life. So I very much advocate for medication. And yeah, that same psychiatrist also told me that, you know, you can try to do it without medication, but like if that chemical deficit exists, like it's the therapy isn't going to be as effective if you still have the chemical deficit in your brain, you know, because I can tell you to do all these things all day long, but like if you can't get out of bed, like you're not going to do them. So sometimes you need the medication to start working, and then the therapy, and then like the therapy will actually start working, because you'll have like a, you know, a, for lack of a better phrase, a will to live to actually do it. So
yeah, I've found that sometimes when I just take the medication, I will be like the things that I normally stress about when I'm not on medication, like they just kind of go out of my brain. So I can't even like deal with them. And so I'm like vaguely like, there's still a problem here, but I don't know what it is and I don't really care what it is. So therapy is definitely the part that like helps you connect those dots and like really deal with whatever you're going through.
Yeah. And as somebody with aggressive ADHD, I have to talk through my thoughts a lot because my thoughts aren't very linear. So like once I start saying them, they start to make a lot more sense to me also. So it helps to say shit out loud.
Yeah, for
sure.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I think I actually just had a patient the other day at work who they'd recently been hospitalized for their eating disorder, and like they'd been medically stabilized, so they moved to our program, and they've been trying as much as they can to like eat. And like part of our program is helping a lot of these patients like normalize their eating behaviors. And she's trying her best. She's doing what she can. And she comes into it with the right attitude. Like I'm going to eat this. I'm going to finish my meals. But she was prescribed olanzapine the other day as a medication. And it's just like to kind of help bridge the gap. Like it's not like a magic wand that'll like fix everything right away, but to just be able to, basically with the olanzapine, they're trying to use the side effects to help her out. So it'll make her sleepy.
Yeah.
Yep. It'll make her sleepy and it'll make her hungry. So we're just trying to use the side effects to where she can use that. And as she's getting more practice of eating and like seeing that it's okay to eat and, you know, nothing bad happens after eating, then she's starting to kind of rewire like her brain and being able to see like things will be okay as I eat.
Yeah. For sure. I've always had like issues with food. I'm like a naturally very petite person, and like whereas most people, I feel like, or at least as far as like what I hear by and large, you can correct me if that's not actually true, but like I feel like most people talk about being emotional eaters, and I don't hear as many people talk about being like emotional like fasters, which is what I think the category that I fall into, where if I'm stressed or angry or upset in any way, I can't eat. And so I've always had issues like keeping my weight like healthy. And like the day, well, I'm not on Zoloft anymore. I'm now on Lexapro. But when I was on Zoloft, I remember like the day that it started working, I was at work. And at the time I worked at a coffee shop, and we had all of these pastries in the back. And I remember just like looking at these cookies that I never liked before and being like, I need to eat absolutely every single one of them right now. And like, I couldn't stop eating. Yeah. So sometimes, yeah, those side effects can help like the other stuff too. And also having ADHD and having to be on like stimulant medication, like the Lexapro kind of helps me also continue to have an appetite. And so the two medications together really balance each other out for me.
Yeah. Awesome. I'm glad that's been really useful for you. I think.
Oh yeah. Big fan of Lexapro.
that's what I've heard. That's my favorite antidepressant. So you're speaking my language. It's the best in terms of side effects. And it's probably the most useful one we have too. But I think to go back to our previous point, like a lot of people I talk to, they say like, I want to do this on my own. I can do it on my own. I don't need any medications. And I say, you're absolutely right. You can do this on your own and you will do this on your own, but medications might make it a little bit easier for you. Like you don't have to lift 100-pound weight if you can lift a 50-pound weight instead. You know, it just makes it easier for people to reach their goals.
Yeah. I think a lot of people have an attitude about it where it's like, oh, it's like cheating. Especially with ADHD, people feel like I used to feel this way. I felt super guilty about needing to take Adderall every day to just like be a person. people make a lot of snide comments about like, oh, it's basically meth, which in our last episode, we talked about how it's not meth.
Yeah, I listened to that. That was cool. I liked how you guys did that. That was good.
Yeah, that's one of my like favorite things to get on my soapbox about. but like I used to feel a lot of guilt about it. And now I realized like, dude, Adderall isn't the thing that makes me smart and capable. It's just the thing that makes it easier for me to like live up to the potential that I already have. And like, and the quicker you come to that realization, the easier it is to just accept needing medication and the fact that it's okay. And yeah, Lexapro is awesome. And I've always described, after being on Zoloft, I've always described Lexapro as like Zoloft's like younger, hotter sister, because it's like Zoloft without all the bullshit that Zoloft caused me. Like it made me nauseous just like 24/7, which was super fun. But you know, if Zoloft works for you, great.
Zoloft is the highest nausea rate for any medication or any antidepressant, so that's common, unfortunately.
Yeah, and that one hit me. Oh my god, Ronnie's neighbors.
You're going for it.
They're really committed to
some real method acting going on. Yeah.
Yeah, for real. Seriously. All right, so our next question, and this one I actually am really curious about too, as someone who has this, comorbidity of different disorders like anxiety and depression, ADHD and depression, OCD and anxiety, like what have you seen in your experience tends to be the relationship between those disorders and why a lot of them tend to come in pairs? Like ADHD so often comes with depression or anxiety, or even both if you're super lucky.
Yeah. Well, I would say that, you know, even more than just our clinical observations, we know that 50% of people with depression also have comorbid anxiety. A lot of these symptoms or conditions, depression and anxiety, OCD, they are all very similar. And that's why a lot of our treatments for these are very similar. We use SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which are a type of antidepressant, to treat a lot of these, because we know, especially with like OCD, you tend to have a deficiency of serotonin in your brain. And we know if we add serotonin to your brain, it'll help depression and anxiety. So that's why a lot of these are very related. It's because a lot of it has to do with serotonin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but like, isn't OCD kind of just a manifestation of certain anxieties?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
You have an anxiety about a specific thing, and that is your obsession. And then your compulsion is to do something that relieves the anxiety for you. So, I mean, the typical example is like someone who locks doors like a certain amount of time. So they have this fear that the door is not going to be unlocked and all the things that can happen after your door is unlocked. And so they have to lock it a certain amount of times, and that makes them feel good, just checking it and locking it. So that's the compulsion side, is the locking it over and over and over again. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It is a form of anxiety.
Yeah. I know some things, but yeah, my older brother has pretty intense OCD, and I believe he's on, well, he also has ADHD. So I think he's on like a combination of like Wellbutrin and something else. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Hmm. Excellent explanation.
Well, thank you.
And then, I mean, I always like describe the relationship between like ADHD and depression as being like, I mean, to put it like very simply and in the way that I tend to put things is like, I don't know, having ADHD is really depressing sometimes. Is it like the living with ADHD that kind of leads to the depression? Or is it also just like the fact that you just don't have enough dopamine in your brain and that you're therefore more likely to also have a deficiency of serotonin? Or...
Yeah, I don't think that we have like a for sure answer to that question from a scientific and evidence-based standpoint, but I think you're absolutely right. Like, and I really liked your last episode on ADHD and how it talked about how basically we treat people for ADHD so they can fit this capitalist idea that you need to work at all costs. So kids with ADHD grow up in an environment where they're constantly told that inherently there's something wrong with them, that you're not right. You can't focus. You should be able to do X, Y, and Z. And we're even going to go ahead and put you on strong medications to make you be able to do X, Y, and Z. And I think there's a huge psychological component there where kids just feel like, wow, there must be something wrong with me. But even on like a deeper, you know, biological, neurochemical basis too, yeah, there are imbalances in there. And what we know about ADHD is that your frontal lobe, so that front part of your brain, that's your executive functioning part of your brain, it takes a lot longer to develop in people with ADHD. And what we know is that if you have a strong frontal lobe, that can actually help prevent anxiety and depression. So if you have a delay in that, you're more prone to depression and anxiety when you're young.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. I didn't think about the executive function part of it, I guess. Well, I'm also not a scientist, so I wouldn't have known that. Yeah, because I'm definitely like in an emotionally abusive relationship with my executive function. This is also another question that I am constantly asking myself. How do you know if things are improving or just staying steady?
That's a good question. I think from my side of things, like as the therapist, a big thing that I see this on social media come up every once in a while, and it always like makes me feel like warm and fuzzy inside because people like stick up for us. Because I'll be the first to admit, like when I majored in psychology, like there was not a lot hard about it. Like there's not a lot of hard classes. Like psychology is like a softer science. Like the hardest class I had was like intro to neuroscience. And there was just not a lot like difficult about it. So I think a lot of people would always like kind of downplay or like talk down to like psychology or mental health in general. But as a therapist, like when we see somebody and we're meeting with somebody, like we are working to develop a treatment plan, and a treatment plan that we set like pretty clear objectives and goals and things that we're trying to measure so that we know like when things are improving or when they're getting better or when we need to change things. So we're trying to like work together with our patient and our client to develop like what are some things that you want to see better? Like if we take an example of like my eating disorder patients, like one of our objectives is that they will eat 80% of their meal plan for the week, as evidenced by like self-report or report by their parents, like things like that. And by monitoring those things and like trying to like pay attention to those things, that's how we can kind of tell what's working, what's not. And like treatment plans are like living documents. Like we make changes to those all the time. Like I made a treatment plan earlier today and I know I'm about to like change it in 2 days. Like that's how they work, but that's part of the science, the scientific process of the therapy and treatment plans.
Mm-hmm. And from a psychiatric side, I don't know if you've ever had to fill out like paperwork or a PHQ-9 or a GAD-7 in your doctor's office, but there's been a huge push in psychiatry to become more objective. So using like rating scales. So oftentimes if I have a patient come in for depression, they'll fill out a PHQ-9 or patient health questionnaire 9, which gives us a score for depression. And it's actually pretty accurate too. And so if the patient comes back in a month, they say like, yeah, I'm feeling a little bit better. I'll base my opinion of if they're getting better on what they tell me. I find that very important. I'm actually doing better today. I'll also check their score. So if a month ago they were a 20 on their PHQ-9 and now they're a 15, I'll say, okay, we're making some improvement. The score is down. That means we're getting better. And also we look at things like your mental status exam. So a lot of people who are really depressed, you can tell a little bit that they're depressed because they'll have what we call like psychomotor retardation. Their affect will be blunted. So they'll be kind of a little bit more flat and they'll be like, yeah, I'm pretty depressed. And that's like for really severely depressed people. And then if they look a little bit brighter, if they're looking better, we use that too. So a couple of different metrics we use to grade and objectively determine if people are actually getting better with our treatment.
Yeah. I had a psychiatrist tell me, it was like the first follow-up after I started Zoloft. they were asking me how I was feeling, and I was saying that, I don't feel that great, but everybody at work has been telling me that I seem so much better, which is weird because I don't feel better. And he said that affect comes before mood, and so like other people will notice before you do. So then after that, we like upped the dose, and then I felt great after that. So I don't know, I always like held on to that little phrase. It's that like sometimes other people will notice the change in you before you do. Is that something that you've heard before or have any thoughts on?
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I'll let you talk more about this, Ed, too, but a lot of times we don't really see changes in ourselves very often. And you know, I'll oftentimes always ask, you know, family members like, hey, are you noticing any changes? Of course, with the permission of the patient to talk to the family. But it always helps to have an extra set of eyes and outside eyes because, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Affect does change a little bit before the actual mood itself. So, yeah, it's nice to have other sets of eyes looking and seeing how you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, we do that a lot with like my teenage patients and just trying to see like what other people have noticed. Even with my adult patients, I'll get a lot of the time where they'll come into my office and we're having a session and they'll let me know, like, I just don't know if I'm doing any better. I feel like I'm not getting any better, and like having to, you know, pull up their chart and be like, well, actually, like, just from my side of things, like you've completed your meal plan every day for this week, or you have participated actively in every group that I've been in, things like that, that we notice, because a lot of the time, like you just can't tell sometimes. Like you're people that are struggling, you're trying to do the best you can, and you're carrying a big weight on your shoulders, and you're trying to like take care of everything else around you. So you don't always have time to notice, like, am I feeling better? Like you don't always have time to just take a break during the day and see, like, am I doing better? So that's why it's helpful to have like your therapist or psychiatrist or health professional to kind of be the one to monitor that for you. That's a big thing. We want to monitor for you so that we can kind of make you aware of like the positive changes that are happening.
Yeah, it seems like having like a support system around you, like a combination of like, you know, your doctor being a part of that support system and also like the people in your life to kind of give you that feedback as things are changing with you. Because yeah, like I can never tell how I'm doing or if I'm doing better. And it really does sometimes take like other people telling me for me to like actually see it.
Yeah. A big thing we see too is that with adult patients, teenage patients, is I let them know, like, I want to have your support person as involved as possible. Because even like for our adult treatment program, like they're there every day from 8:30 till 3:30, Monday through Saturday. And there's a lot of treatment time, but still there's a lot of time outside of treatment that none of us are there to monitor. So you can do all the work in program. You can, you know, come to all your sessions. You can do everything we need you to do. But if your support person is not involved, like eventually you're going home to them, right? Eventually you're going to be around mom and dad or, you know, a significant other. And we want them to be a part of it so they have a better understanding of how to best support you and how to best take care of you as much as they can.
That's a good point. So I guess the next thing would be, how do you know when it's time to search out a diagnosis for a secondary thing? And this is coming from like a person wondering, okay, I've been diagnosed with one thing, but do I have something else? How much time should I stay with this diagnosis and what the doctor is telling me for this one thing before I move on to the next thing?
It is a little dependent on the situation. But I think right now, I mean, if you feel like you've got the wrong diagnosis, if you feel like you're not being treated for the right thing, it's okay to talk to your doctor and be like, you know, I've always wondered about this instead. Like, I mean, even just recently, like, I'd been treating this lady for depression and nothing was working. We tried multiple different medications, and then, you know, she was like, oh, you know, I've always wondered about thyroid issues. And I was like, have you been tested for thyroid issues in the past? And she was like, yeah, they tried to put me on medications in the past, but I couldn't afford them. I'm like, wow, there's our problem right there. So it's like, A good psychiatrist with a reasonable ego will always be able to say, like, okay, let's reexamine this. Do I have it wrong? Should we be switching things up? Like, so hopefully, not every mental health provider has a healthy ego, but hopefully they do. And hopefully they're at least willing to listen and hear your feedback and see if you think your diagnosis is wrong.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I like to, when I go to the doctor, I try to like make a list of like things I want to bring up to them, because if I don't bring something up, like how do they know if it's not something that like they're going to see in a 30-minute appointment, right? So I think like just in my unqualified opinion, like I think you really have to make sure that you're communicating effectively to your doctor, because it is like a two-way street where like they can only help you with something if you tell them. So like if you feel like they're missing something, or like maybe kind of reflect on, okay, well, how am I communicating this to them? Because I know for me, I downplay stuff all the time. And like, I don't make things sound as serious as they actually are. And so kind of taking a step back and seeing how effectively you are communicating to your doctor. And then like, if that doesn't, you know, if that doesn't help, you can always, well, not always, but sometimes you can seek out a second opinion, and then just like coming in with questions and making sure that like, you know, I think it's better to give them more information than they need than not enough. Like the fact that one patient never brought up the thyroid thing, right? Like that's, maybe if she had brought that up sooner, not to say that it's like in any way her fault, but it's like, oh, like that's something that like, maybe that's one of the things that you put on your list when you're going to the doctor, is like, oh, I should also mention that this is a thing that's come up before. Like I always mention to doctors who don't know me that like, oh, and by the way, my iron levels always come up low on tests. I can never remember what the gene is called, but it's some gene that like a lot of like Eastern Europeans have, I think, where you were just like anemic always.
Do you have thalassemia?
That's what it is. Thank you.
We're going to have
4 years in med school really paid off just now.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, that. So I always bring that up, because if I don't bring that up, they're like, okay, let's run some more tests and like, let's do all these things. I'm like, let me just make sure you know that this is a thing that like, don't be surprised by this, I guess.
Yeah.
So just like making sure that you're like putting everything on the table for them so that they have the most to work with, I guess.
Yeah. I tell a lot of patients that, you know, I can go to school for however long, and I could have studied and been a therapist for however long. But at the end of the day, like the patients that I work with and the families, like they're the experts. Like I'm trying to learn from them so that I can see how to best meet their needs. At the end of the day, like I can read whatever book I want, but I'm not going to know a person until they, you know, can share as much info as they can with me.
So how do you go about getting a diagnosis in terms of navigating the mental health field?
That is a good question. I think there's a number of ways. I mean, there's seeing a PCP, a primary care physician. I've seen a lot of times where someone will go in to see their regular doctor for the yearly checkup, and by the end of it have an idea that they might be struggling with depression or anxiety, and then they get referred to like a mental health clinic or a psychiatrist or a psychologist. So psychologists can all diagnose. Those are people with doctorates in psychology, either a PhD or a PsyD. Master's level clinicians like myself, therapists, we can diagnose, psychiatrists can diagnose. So those are all kind of the mental health professionals, and I think even like psychiatric nurse practitioners, all different levels and different types of jobs, but they all have the ability to give a diagnosis. And that comes from, you know, like extensive evaluation. And we're not just, for the most part, I mean, I hope nobody's doing it, but we're not just going to like see you for 10 minutes and give you a diagnosis from the DSM-5, but it comes after some eval and usually a bigger assessment. But again, that's just going back to the last point, we're just trying to know who you are and figure out who you are so we can give you the best, the clearest picture possible.
Yeah. And Ed, you brought up the DSM-5, and we use this all the time because and it's so familiar to us, but that stands for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual version number 5. And it is basically like the guidebook to mental health. I mean, that's literally where every psychiatric and psychological disorder is laid out in terms of, you have to have this many symptoms to meet this criteria of this diagnosis. So any mental health professional worth their scruples, nobody says that, but I'm going to go for it, will use the DSM-5. And if they tell you have depression or bipolar or schizophrenia, they'll be able to go through the DSM-5 and say like, oh, they had two symptoms, which qualifies as or meets criteria for this diagnosis. You can't just like ask someone, hey, are you depressed? And they say, yeah. And you go, okay, you've got depression. You have to ask about the symptoms. Like, do you have poor sleep? Do you have anhedonia? Do you have some guilt? Do you have low energy, poor concentration? You have psychomotor slowing, suicidal thoughts. Like, you have to go through the each individual criteria for each condition.
Mm-hmm. And like, as far as like a, like bringing it, because I know at least for me, I've gone through like a lot of different doctors just for a myriad of reasons. Actually, I've had like three different psychiatrists just like leave the practice on me. I hope it wasn't me.
It's not you. I could just tell it's not you. Don't worry.
I know I'm difficult, but it's always difficult like bringing stuff up to a new person. Especially I've noticed even in LA where a lot of the all of the psychiatrists I've met are like super progressive and not super judgmental, but it still happens sometimes where, especially with adult ADHD, there are still a lot of doctors that like kind of think that adult ADHD isn't really a thing. Or like because of the association with like Adderall, it always feels like an interrogation sometimes with certain doctors where they're trying to figure out like, do you actually have ADHD or are you just gonna get a prescription so that you can sell this Adderall? So sometimes depending on like what the thing is, like it's hard to kind of like broach the topic.
Yeah, that is a good question. I have had a lot of people come in saying like, yeah, I have had ADHD my whole life, or at least I thought I did, but my parents were like very anti-medicine. So I mean, I couldn't even go and get assessed for ADHD until I was an adult out of their house. So you're absolutely right. There's a lot of stigma around ADHD, and a lot of providers have this kind of us versus or me versus them mentality of everyone's just trying to get drugs out of me. Everyone's trying to get benzos and stimulants out of me. And that's unfortunate that some people have that mindset, because there are a lot of adults out there with adult ADHD. There are some objective tests that you can do, like neuropsychological testing, that will give you like a score or within a reasonable shadow of a doubt that says that you do or do not have ADHD. But yeah, I feel you. And I think a lot of people who do switch providers, they dread that question or dread bringing it up. They're like, oh, I've got to plead my case. You wouldn't have to do that with depression. You wouldn't have to do that with bipolar. People would just believe you. But with ADHD, unfortunately, that does happen.
Yeah. I think I've seen too, a lot of my own patients, not with just ADHD, but just the fear of having to like retell their story and like almost again, having to get like some other professional to like believe whatever they're saying is really hard. And I think my biggest thing and what I try to do, and I know Justin does the same, is just trying to, anytime we meet a patient for the first time who has a history of any type of like mental health disorder, is just trying to come with them with the most open mind possible. Because at the end of the day, we're there to help them out, and they're there for a reason, and we're there for a reason. So we want to make sure that we are making this as comfortable as possible for them, because it is hard. You spend time with a provider for however long, and then, you know, doctor, whoever comes in now, or, you know, a new therapist comes in, and now it's like, I have to start from square one. Like, I really don't want to do that. Like, I've been working with this person for a long time, and I'm really not trying to do that. So I think as much as it's, you know, trying to empower the patient to feel like they can start from square one, it falls on us too, as the professionals, to provide the safe space and the open space for a new patient to be able to just put it all out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think everybody, a lot of doctors are still like recovering from like the, when like everybody was getting prescribed Adderall, like everybody was. And sometimes I think that stuff is a little bit overblown, but like there were a lot of kids that were like misdiagnosed with ADHD that like grow up and they're like, yeah, no, I definitely didn't. I was just, you know, I was just an asshole. and so I feel like a lot of like doctors like still like have this mindset of like, basically the pendulum swung the other way, where before like they were diagnosing everybody's kids with ADHD, and now they're like a little too conservative about it, and so maybe over over time, like that pendulum will kind of like reach a center point. Because yeah. I mean, we've done a couple of episodes about ADHD just because I have a bias towards it because I love mm-hmm. talking about it. But mm-hmm. a lot of the like research that I've done for those episodes, like what I have found is that so much of what we know about ADHD is like stuff that we've only learned in the last like 20 years, yeah. even like 15, 10 years. Like rejection sensitive dysphoria. We did a whole episode about that because I had never heard of this before. And then I like read a couple of white papers on it and I was like, holy shit, like, why did no one tell me about this? This is crazy. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about rejection sensitive dysphoria is it gets misdiagnosed as like a bunch of other like personality disorders all the time. Mm-hmm. I think it needs to be like a shift in the conversation or our understanding of different disorders and kind of breaking down those barriers. And also just like, you know, if a doctor isn't listening to you, again, like find a new one.
Yeah.
If you can.
All right. So the next thing, I've had this problem before and also right now.
Ronnie and I had a long debate about this one because we'll get into it. But
yeah, so the topic is libido and mental health / medication. So let's talk libido on men when people are experiencing issues with their mental health, and then libido on SSRIs or like other medications as well. But like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you deal with it? Because I feel like so many like people I've known have been like, yeah, I'm gonna try this different SSRI because like I have no sex drive on this one. And then they switch to the new one and it's the same thing. And I like, when Ronnie and I were talking about it, I was like, I don't care what they tell you. They all do that. Like, it, like what do you do? Ronnie and I are both single. So we're like, oh, it's like literally, it's great. It's the best thing. Like, I never think about sex. It's awesome. Like, we're like, oh, but that's probably not why someone would be asking us about this.
Yeah. Well, I guess as the psychiatrist, I should probably handle this one.
I think so.
So yeah, I think before we talk about the medication side of it, yes, mental health can absolutely affect your libido in both positive and negative ways. Like if you're really depressed, you're not going to be wanting to have sex. But also if you have bipolar disorder and you're really manic, you're going to be wanting to have sex all the time. So your natural fluctuations in mood can lead to differences in your libido. But you're absolutely right. Yeah, SSRIs, in 70% of people, they affect your libido or sexual drive in some way, shape, or form. That could be libido. That can also be anorgasmia, so the inability to have an orgasm. So certain SSRIs are worse for this. The ones that we know is the absolute worst is Paxil or paroxetine. Luckily, we don't use this a ton. And probably the best one is Lexapro, in terms of just overall that has the least amount of side effects. Some people will actually use that sexual dysfunction side effect as a tool. So for example, if you have premature ejaculation, which really plagues a lot of people in this world, you can take an SSRI such as Paxil or paroxetine, and it will allow you to have like sex for a normal amount of time, or at least allow you to have sex for an enjoyable amount of time and not just, well, we all know what happens when you're a premature ejaculator. And also, you know, I think the show Ozark did a really good job of depicting this, but the character Ben had bipolar disorder and he was on medications and said that, yeah, the medications for bipolar, some of the mood stabilizers too, can lower your libido and inhibit your ability to have an erection as well. So that's unfortunately one of the side effects of our medications. And it's something that I always try and tell people. If I put someone on an SSRI, I tell them, I say, hey, this more than likely is going to mess with your sex drive or your ability to have an orgasm. I want you to be aware of it so you don't just stop the medication. Because if it's helping you with your depression, we want to figure out something that can work. And what you can actually do, so if you've got sexual side effects with an SSRI, you can switch the SSRI. So say you're on Paxil and that's the worst one. You can switch over to Lexapro, which would probably be the best one. If you're still having sexual actual side effects on Lexapro, you can add what we call an augmentation agent. And you said your brother was on Wellbutrin, I believe.
Yeah.
So Wellbutrin, if you add that to an SSRI, that can help negate the effects, the sexual side effects of SSRIs. Also, another medication called Buspirone can do that too. So there's options.
I've been on that one. Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't necessarily have to live. You don't have to live with those sexual side effects. There's something you can do. And then if all else fails, you can always try the phosphodiesterase inhibitors, such as like Viagra, sildenafil. Those can, and even in women too, you can use Viagra for sexual side effects of SSRIs too. So there's options. You don't have to live with those sexual side effects.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard that before. And yeah, it was funny when you were listing medications. I was like, I've been on that one and that one and that one. I was in a relationship with somebody who was on Paxil for a really long time. And I was on like a very high dose of Zoloft at the time. And Ronnie and I were talking about this and I was like, yeah, no, we just never fucked and it was fine. Like, because neither of us cared. But then I was like thinking about how like, oh, but if you're like in a relationship with somebody who isn't on like a medication like that, and then there's kind of like this weird push and pull where like someone has a much higher, I mean, and this happens in relationships where medication isn't a part of the equation, but like where someone has a much higher sex drive than the other one, than the other person. And what I was thinking about it is like, in all of the times that has come up in my life where it's been a problem, honestly, I really just needed to advocate more for myself or just say something, be like, hey, this is a thing, sorry, like, just so you know. A lot of people just don't want to go on SSRIs because of that. And the thing is like, well, would you rather like, you know, do you want to feel like dying or do you want to come? Like, it's kind of, it depends on where your priorities are. But yeah. Like I think for most people, it's like your mental health has to come first and you need to communicate that to the person that you're in a relationship with if it becomes a problem.
Yeah.
That's something I wish I had done.
In singledom for me, I'm actually really, you made a connection in my brain when you talked about Wellbutrin, because I took that with Prozac, and that was before this round of Prozac now, and I took that, so it, like, I had the energy, I didn't really have the side effects. Now I'm taking it, I got the side effects, but I am not mad because I have a lot more time to think about other things, which is usually nothing, but wow, there's so much more space for thinking.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a bad thing, because honestly, if you're single and on SSRIs and have no sex drive, it's honestly fantastic.
Yeah,
from my personal experience, like, no, this is great. I never think about it. And then the next question we got was, are antidepressants the only way to get out of extreme anxiety?
No. They can help. I think kind of what we talked about earlier, they can help you get over the anxiety and help it easier to cope with. But I'll let Ed take over from here. Like, therapy is probably the thing that's going to help long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we a lot of the time, I mean, we don't want to give someone a medication that, you know, we don't want a 17-year-old coming into our office and we give them this medication with the expectation that for the next 60 plus years, that's just what you're going to be taking, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we want to be able to help develop these coping skills and these coping strategies, and just to almost gain insight into their disorder and into their symptoms, so that they feel that they can take them, that they can deal with them better and cope with them better. I think a lot of the time with something like anxiety, patients will avoid certain things for so long, or just like be so anxious about certain things that they don't know. Because a lot of anxiety is like the fear of the unknown, right? Like, we just don't know what's going to happen. Like, one of the main symptoms of anxiety is like fear that something bad is going to happen, like, even if there's no proof that it's going to happen. So a lot of times we get patients who are struggling with anxiety, and they have struggled with it for so long around a certain topic. And what's coming to mind now is like a lot of my eating disorder patients, is they get so anxious around certain foods or certain drinks or certain things that they have to consume that they just avoid it. And they go years without eating it, and they go years without drinking like orange juice, things like that, because they think something bad is going to happen. They're so anxious that something bad is going to happen. So part of it could be kind of like the desensitization and like the almost like in vivo, like live exposure. So kind of like exposure therapy. Like a good example is we had a patient who was a college student. I mean, obviously right now there's not a lot of in-person college stuff, but they had reported right before COVID hit that they struggled a lot with eating in the cafeteria because they didn't want anybody seeing them eat. So the therapist took that and they would walk the patient to the cafeteria at the hospital across the street, and they would eat lunch together in the cafeteria just to kind of get that practice of like what it's actually like to eat live after you've gotten all these, you know, new coping skills, new coping strategies, and had this practice of gaining more insight into your situation. So yeah, I mean, medications can definitely be helpful, but they're not going to be like, just like therapy is not the magic wand that fixes everything right away, medications also aren't, in a lot of cases, the magic wand that fixes everything.
Yeah, I think one analogy I really like with anxiety in therapy is like, imagine you're in a scary movie. My scariest movie is Blair Witch Project, because I'm super afraid of getting lost in the woods. So imagine you're in a scary movie, you feel your heart race, you feel that anxiety, but you can tell yourself, you use that frontal lobe to be able to say, I'm in a movie, I'm okay, I'm sitting down in a chair, this is all right. That's your frontal lobe helping to control the amygdala, that fear center of your brain. So essentially what therapy is trying to do is to give you insight into that fear and to give that frontal lobe extra power so you can control your fear centers in your brain over time.
I have a personal, I'm going to use this time to get some free therapy. So it sounds like CBT to me, with cognitive behavioral therapy. And how would I go about getting over a very irrational fear of needles?
Oh, I know what this is. Yeah, I knew he was going to say that.
What was that? A fear of what?
Needles.
Needles? Yeah. I think what I see a lot of times with like anxiety and like fear is the these automatic negative thoughts come up, where we call them ants. And it's just like, again, when I mentioned earlier, like in school, like I was not the most sciencey person, but one of the things I did remember a lot was in neuro was with your neurons, like the neurons that fire together, wire together. So your brain is pretty much like wired to like associate like needles with like something bad or like something dangerous. And like the connection is so strong and it happens so rapidly. Like I'm sure a lot of the time you can't even stop yourself. Like when you start thinking about needles and how like scary they could be.
Yeah. That's gonna scream right now.
So one of the main like coping strategies that I like to use is checking the facts. I think I like that one the most because it helped me a lot. Like when I first started seeing a therapist, that's another thing we wanted to mention at some point, is like therapists and mental health professionals all should and yeah, just should have experience with being in therapy at some point themselves. But anyway, when I was in therapy, I think the checking the facts one was so helpful for me because you practice, and again, it's practice. You're not going to be good at it right away. I was not good at it right away, and I'm a therapist. That's the worst part. It's like, I should know this, but like, I needed somebody else to tell me. But checking the facts as far as like looking at the situation, taking all the emotion out of it and just thinking about the facts. So for me, it was a worry that I did. This was, and this is a real life example. Like I always would be worried when my girlfriend didn't text me back at some point. And I'd look back at text messages and be like, man, did I say something stupid? Like I check all my social media. What did I post? Like, did I post something wrong? Like, what am I doing here? Like, why is she not text me back? And I just, for whatever reason, couldn't get out of that cycle until I learned and like practiced the checking the facts and just taking all the emotion out of it and realizing like, oh, she's at work, or, oh, we've been together for a long time now, and I know she's just not a good texter. Like these are all like factual things that when you're able to practice them and like look at them and lay them out and like practice, the more you practice, the easier it gets. It should help kind of reducing just anxiety and fear around certain things. So that's one little tool we'd like to throw out there.
Yeah, the people like not texting you back and like people hating you or thinking that people hate you is something that Ronnie and I have talked about extensively because we both do that.
I hope that's helpful, Ronnie. I just want to throw that out there.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, I've felt that about people where, you know, you think they hate you and you're like, eh. And I've done that where you just take the emotion out of it. I'm trying to take the emotion out of needles and it's still there. So jury's out.
But Ronnie did his civic duty recently and got a flu shot. So he's nice. Here a little
there
bit.
You go. Yeah.
We are going to positively reinforce you for that, Ronnie. Yeah, good job. Yeah. Also, there's this like really like obscure mental health podcast that did a whole episode on phobias. If you're interested, too.
That's right. Might I help saw you. That. Yeah.
He's going to plug it.
No shame, Ed. No shame.
Yeah. No, for sure. I mean, we plug like 5 or 6 of our own episodes in every episode because we're like, well, we talked about this one time in this other episode, just in case. But on like, this is a weird experience that I had with like anxiety because I don't have anxiety. However, for a period of time, I was having insane panic attacks where, you know, the kind where you think that you're having a heart attack and you're going to die. Mm-hmm. And for me, they were lasting like 6 to 12 hours and it was horrifying. And then a psychiatrist, you mentioned the medication, it's Buspirin. Buspirin, is that what
Buspirone
it's called?
Buspirone or Buspar, yes.
Buspirone, yeah. I had a doctor prescribe that to me, and I didn't like taking it because it made me just sleep. And so he told me to just like, just fill the prescription and then don't take it. And then if something happens and you're having a panic attack, then take it. And honestly, just having it like in my bag all the time, I didn't have any more panic attacks after that because the scariest thing for me was like after I had a panic attack, I was so scared of it happening again that I would just like freak out. But then I knew like, well, if it happens, I have this medication that I can take if I need it and I'll be okay and I won't die. Something like that kind of like break glass in case of emergency medication thing is also potentially, I mean, if you don't want to be on antidepressants all the time, but like if you have an experience like I did where you would have these like 6 to 12 hour panic attacks, like it honestly made me feel so much better knowing that like I can just like break glass in case of emergency and take this pill if shit goes wrong.
Yeah. Did you ever end up taking it?
No, I never ended up taking it because as soon as I had it, I didn't have any more panic attacks because I knew that if it happened, it wasn't going to be the end of the world.
Yeah. I think that happens a lot with people with like panic disorder where they like they have a ongoing fear that a panic attack is coming. So it's like they just can't like function. Mm-hmm. So just like the for especially and with just anxiety in general, like a lot of people just don't have like or they don't think about just like that I'm gonna be okay because of this. So I think just the fact that you had like I'm gonna be okay because I have this in my bag and I have this with me at all times, so if it comes, fuck it, I don't care, like I'm good to go. So it's kind of cool just like that like reassurance even though you never had to use it.
Yeah, no, it was honestly like crazy. And I don't even have that prescription anymore. And I haven't had a panic attack in over a year because it was definitely like a situational thing. But as soon as I got over that fear of it happening, yeah, it just went away. Thank God.
Yeah, nice.
And then our next question we got was therapy and finding the right therapist /doctor/meds and how to know if they're the right therapist, doctor, medications, and if they're working.
I think when it comes to therapists, it really just depends on how you're feeling working with them. I think what a lot of people don't think about is that like just because you get paired up with a therapist doesn't mean like you're attached to them for life. Same thing with like coming back to therapy. A lot of people and I blame it on society, but like a lot of people like don't think that they can come back to therapy in general. They think that like you get a stamp card, and once you get your therapy stamp card, like that's it, like you can't come back. But you know, you can always come back. I think what I would look out for, like, and what I used like in my own, like when I was finding a therapist, is like if I dread going to see my therapist, or if I don't think I'm being listened to, or if the therapist spends more time talking over me than listening to me, because for some people it's helpful to have a therapist that talks a lot and like helps them walk through things. But if they feel like the therapist is just talking over me constantly, that's another sign. I think if you find the therapist just like talks about themselves more than you and like trying to help you out with
then
your
they need to go to therapy probably
that too but just like that's not something you want. And also like if the therapist is just like sketchy in their boundaries, like wanting to add you on Facebook or like texting you outside of therapy or things like that, like checking in on you when that wasn't agreed upon like in the relationship, those would be some signs I would look out for if I, you know, think therapist might not be right for me. But as far as like on the flip side, the positive, just like if you look forward to going to therapy, if you like have positive thoughts and emotions related to your therapist, as far as like they are helpful to me, they have helped make me feel better, things like that, I think those are all good signs that you have a good therapist for you.
Mm-hmm. And there's this theory of goodness of fit. Like not every person is going to match up with every person, and that's okay. If you feel like you don't match up with a provider, get a new one, try a new one. It's okay. Like, you know, you might hurt somebody's feelings, but it's your mental health. You got to put a priority on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for sure. I heard somebody say once, and I cannot for the life of me remember who, say that they treated finding a therapist like dating.
Mm-hmm.
Like you really have to, because you know there is like definitely like a, not in like the bad connotation, but there is like a power dynamic where you feel like, oh, this person is an authority figure, and so everything they say is like the word of God, and it's not. Mm-hmm. And so you have to think of them as an equal, I guess. So that's why it's like easier for us to like go on a bad date and then never talk to that person again. Whereas like it feels harder to break up with a doctor or a therapist, but it's mm-hmm. not. Yeah. So I really liked the dating analogy.
I think that's good. I think that's a fault to a lot of like graduate schools or programs. And I will say, I mean, it was kind of taught to me like that in my grad program, where there was like no self-disclosure. Don't tell your patients about yourself. Like, don't try to make any other like they don't need to know about your personal life. And to me, it's like, what's the point? Like, how can I expect someone to come see me most of the time at their lowest points? How can I expect them to come see me, be open and honest with me, and be willing to like work with me if they don't know at least a little bit about me? If they don't, and I tell a lot of my patients, I mean, it's in my professional disclosure statement, like this is a therapeutic relationship where we're working together, we're side by side. It's not I'm leading and you're following, like we're next to each other throughout the whole process, and it's none of this like power dynamic stuff, because that's just, I don't know, to me that's weird. And I think that's the fault in a lot of graduate programs and just some therapists in general.
Yeah, you have to like humanize yourself to your patient so that mm-hmm. So that they feel like they're just talking to a person and not, mm-hmm. you know, because then it's like, well, they're just another person. So, which is kind of, maybe that's just a weird me thing, but I'm just like, oh, it's just another person. Like I can just ghost them. But that might just be like a personality flaw in me. But
that's very true.
Yeah. I had a situation where I had a therapist and he was a little too honest with me in that, like, he said, it's all in your head. And I was like, well, I know that, but come on.
Oh, man. So, I'm sorry, Ronnie. That's terrible.
Yeah, that was a tough day.
Man. I thought you were going to say, like, problem. A little. Yeah. I thought you were going to say, like.
It's all in my head.
I thought you were just going to say, like, they talked about, like, I don't know, their bad day real quick. But it's all in your head.
No, yeah, he was sucks, very, he listened to me. You know, looked at me, he was giving me his full attention and was like, don't you think it's in your head? And in my head at that point, I was like, well, yeah, duh, but come on.
That's why I'm here.
Give me something a little more esoteric than that.
Yeah. That also just feels like sometimes when you're trying to talk about like living with a mental illness to somebody who has never had one, who is just like super well adjusted. And I say this as a mm-hmm. joke all the time, but I like kind of totally mean it more than I think I do, that I just like don't trust well adjusted people in like because that's what that says to me, is like, oh, this person literally has either very little experience with patients or like has never had to deal with something like this. Not to say that everybody who like is a mental health professional has to go through like a designated period where they're super depressed. Like it's not like that, but like there's clearly like a misunderstanding of what the other person is going through and a, mm-hmm. and a lack of empathy.
Yeah.
Ronnie and I have both talked about this before. It's like, if you've ever met somebody who's been like, oh, you're depressed, why don't you just like try a keto diet, you'll feel better. And I'm like, actually, go fuck yourself.
I think we all gotta have at least a little episode of trauma in our lives to know like how to better connect with people. But I agree. I think like, well, I don't know. I was just thinking there's back in high school, long story short, the whole football team, we had dinner together the night before and we had food poisoning the next day. Oh. And it was terrible. And like, I remember going to class and like just saying to my teacher, like, this is the worst day of my life. And he like looked at me and he was like, if this is the worst day of your life, then I'm jealous of you. And like, I think about it now and it's like, yeah, I mean, that kind of relates to this where it's like, if someone just hasn't really experienced certain things or they've just kind of had it pretty easy, it's kind of hard to really want to like trust them or really just like trust that they like know what they're talking about, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Which is hard because it's like a lot of people that become therapists don't have that, which is why I was like so curious about what got you into the mental health field, because I am always curious if it's like, did you have a personal experience with it? Because maybe it's not that you went through something, but maybe you had like a mentally ill parent or a mentally ill sibling. And so you grew empathy for those people through that. Because I mean, I have two very mentally ill parents. I mean, all of my like issues are all genetic for the most part. All of my siblings have, you know, a handful of diagnoses. Both of my parents do. And so like, because of that, I just have like a stronger understanding of what that's like. But I've literally, well, actually, I've told this story before and I'm not going to tell the whole story, but basically I dated somebody for almost 2 years who I think had like a frighteningly wholesome family. And that like, like, I'm like, I've never met a family that just likes being together this much. And it's a little bit jarring for me.
Yeah.
And like, it just, I don't know, it made me feel so weird. And when I look back at that, I'm like, yeah, like part of why that like never worked out is because they were just a little too well adjusted. Like they couldn't understand, because I know that I'm like a little bit nutty. And like, if you're not also a little bit nutty, like you're not going to get it. Or if you, or if you just have like such an aggressively wholesome family, where you've never been exposed to that, it's hard to empathize. But you know, I think I said a few episodes back, but like, if your childhood didn't traumatize you, did you have a childhood? I'm not sure. But there are some people who had it really easy, and good for them.
So going away from the medication route, if you aren't doing that and you're opting to do more natural stuff to control your mental health, like exercise, sleep, meditation, breath work, getting more sunlight, that's a big one for me. How long does it take to notice these natural results, if there would be any?
Well, we love this question. We always plug like the four pillars of lifestyle changes that you can make for mental health. And you're absolutely right. Diet, exercise, sleep, and stress management. So like the, you know, the yoga and the breathing exercises is all stress management stuff. Those are the four things that we know, like there's good data, good evidence saying they actually help mental health. And how long does it actually take? That's a good question. It's a little personal. It depends on the person. But it's kind of similar to antidepressants. You have to do them for like 4 weeks solid to be able to notice like a solid difference. Because an interesting thing about antidepressants is that the increase in serotonin itself doesn't really fix anything. But what it does is it allows your brain to heal itself. And so when you're doing all those lifestyle changes, you're giving your brain an environment. You're giving your brain what it needs to heal itself. When you're sleeping more, you're replenishing your neurochemicals naturally. When you're eating better, you're also replenishing your neurochemicals naturally. When you're exercising, you're getting a blast of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is a specific thing that helps your brain heal itself. So yeah, I would say it depends on the person, but around 4 weeks.
Yeah, I'm glad that we had somebody else come on to answer this question, because I am so biased for, and I'm very honest about the fact that I'm like very biased against these other methods of helping your mental health, because I none of them ever really worked for me. I mean, I literally have a tattoo of a heart on my ankle that says SSRIs in it. So like I'm very pro medication.
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
But yeah, I'm very pro medication. And so, but like, just because it didn't work for me, you know, doesn't mean it doesn't work for other people. But also, that's also a great point to where you can't take a medication and expect it to fix all of your problems. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, and I touched on this in the last episode, about people think that like you take Adderall and all your issues go away, and it doesn't. Like, I have been on Adderall for years at this point, and recently especially, like, I've had days where I take my meds like I'm supposed to, and I still like lay in bed for 3 hours, like putting off whatever I'm supposed to do, which sounds ridiculous because like it's like you're literally taking a stimulant medication and then you're still able to like sleep in the middle of the day. And like, yeah, if your ADHD is as bad as mine, yes, you totally can. And I am living proof of that.
Mm-hmm.
A medication can be a part of the bigger picture of your mental health, but it's not the whole picture. And like, if you're taking antidepressants, but you're still like, you know, not getting out of bed at a reasonable time or going to bed at a reasonable time or eating correctly, and then you think, oh, this medication doesn't work, I should stop taking it, then no, you just didn't hold up your half of the bargain.
Yeah. I think my favorite answer as a therapist and just mental health professional in general just is, it depends. Every person is a little different. Every person has different needs. And I think I can definitely see how it'd be hard. Like, if you go on social media and you see, like, especially like things like TikTok, or people be like, day in the life, and like, this is how I take care of my mental health. And they're doing all these like crazy things that like I would never want to. Like, if that's what I needed to do to take care of my mental health, then I don't care.
You're
like,
not going keto.
I'm not going keto. But just like for some people it works and that's great. But we just got to be open-minded to like what works for other people. Like, I think there tends to be like, I don't know, not in general, but there seems to be like a group of people or groups of people who like want to like say like these are the only things that'll work, like exercise more, like get out and run. And it's like, I'm not gonna do any of that. Like, I need something that works for me. Like, that works for you and that's great, but these medications work for me and they have worked for me for a long time, and I'm very thankful for them, and I'm gonna keep using them because this is what keeps me going.
Yeah. And I think that's probably like the reason that I developed such like a militant opinion towards like anybody who tries to tell me to like exercise more and stuff, because it is like that sort of commodification of like quote unquote self-care where,
oh my goodness. Yep.
I'm honestly like, and I'm unironically triggered by the word self-care at this point, because every time every time I see it on social media, it's just some like hot white girl like talking about like fucking SoulCycle or something, and I'm just like, yes, shut the actual fuck up. Like, I can't, like, because the people like that, and it's not to like downplay whatever they go through, but like, yeah, you get anxiety, but like, I have like major depressive disorder. Like, going to SoulCycle isn't going to stop me from feeling this horrible existential dread that I do every day. And so I think, and that's part of the reason why we started this podcast, is that like, I was so sick of like watching people try to sell this like very whimsical picture of like mental health and self-care. And like, that's not what it is. Like, a lot of people have very mild anxiety or very mild depression, or even just like normal depression. And that seems to be the majority of people who like think that they're an authority to talk about like how they deal with their mental health. And it's not like that for most people, I would assume or argue.
Yeah, no, that you put it great. I mean, I think my big thing is, I agree. I think the term self-care and just the hashtag of self-care and like the idea of self-care has like been taken away from the mental health profession.
It's been completely bastardized.
Yeah. And it's been taken away from us as like, this is how you can, you know, working with someone with severe depression or anxiety or, you know, trauma, PTSD, whatever the case may be. And then it's turned into like this Instagram filter that the same girl who went to SoulCycle in the morning is now drinking their latte or whatever from Starbucks and like just making it as trendy as possible when like self-care is not trendy. Like it does not need to be trendy for it to work for you. I think the shitty part with that is that like a lot of people like think they're not allowed to engage in self-care because their self-care is turning off their phone for the rest of the night or watching the same season of The Office. Like that's fine. Like that's all totally fine. But because of how it's blown up on social media as like this very trendy and like pretty way of living, it takes away from how important it can be.
It's invalidating.
I love the fact that you use the word pretty because that's also kind of the joke of our show title. Is that like because it's not pretty, it's very ugly and like like the same girl posting the picture of her latte, like come on, show me you like not getting out of bed for 4 days and then we can talk. Like that's because that's what it is for a lot of people. It is invalidating, like Eddie just said.
Yeah, it is.
Or sorry, Justin just said.
Yeah, it's okay.
No, it really it takes away from the people, and we're not trying to get into a pissing contest of like who has the worst
depression. It's not a competition
but it takes away from people who like really struggle and who really can't get out of bed and who really haven't had a job in years because they struggle so much and who can't get in the car and drive because their anxiety is too bad. Like it really takes away from those people trying to make this into a trendy thing that's just not a big deal.
Yeah, because it's like, and I go on this rant all the time, but like it's you get anxious sometimes. That doesn't mean that you have generalized anxiety disorder. Like the way I think it happened the most with like anxiety is like people love to like claim, this sounds bad, but like love to say that they have anxiety when it's like, I don't know, do you? Like you can get anxious sometimes and not have anxiety. And like, and I think it's because like anxiety is one of the like prettier mental illnesses, quote unquote, right? Like nobody talks about that with like bipolar, right? Like nobody or wants PTSD. To be like, oh, I have PTSD. Like, isn't this cute and trendy? It's like, cause it's not, but like with anxiety that, like the anxiety has gotten bastardized to hell and back. And like, it makes me absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
But like, it's all, everybody's experience is relative. And like, you can still, you can still do your self-care and whatever, like wherever you are on the spectrum of like mental illness, like it's not to say that it's any less valid, but you also have to recognize that other people are suffering more than you, or to just make space for people who have much more intense experiences too, because I don't see enough of that from people, or people are just really good at hiding it.
Mm-hmm.
On our last question, which I really love this one, but how would you suggest navigating a situation where someone in your life clearly needs psychiatric help, but doesn't want to get help and doesn't think their behavior is concerning?
Intervention?
The first thing that came into my mind was the episode in The Office where they take Meredith to rehab like on Christmas just because she has a drinking problem. Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I think, I'm not just going to say it depends, but it really does.
It does, yeah.
It's one of those things where it really, I'm trying not to use depends, but anyway, depending on like your relationship with the person and like how close like you subjectively think you guys are and like how much you've like developed a relationship, it's one of those things that you want to approach like delicately. Like you don't want to just come out and say like, hey, like we need to check you into the hospital because you are just a mess. I think the big thing is that if it's something that it's coming from a place of love and caring and understanding and not a place of like, I'm telling you this because I want to feel better because you are making my life a little worse with what's going on with you. But if it's like I want your life to be better for you, and trying to have like an open discussion and an open dialogue, I think would be a good approach, to a good way to go about it. I think trying to not villainize the person, because again, we just talked about how mental health disorders, the more severe, depending on the disorder, I mean, they can be pretty hard to see, and I don't want to say they can be pretty ugly, but they can be rough and they can be hard to deal with. And it's like, if you're noticing that a person's like struggling and needs psychiatric help, chances are they know that too. And it's just hard for them to kind of take that next step. So I think the biggest thing is for it to come from like a place of love and a place of like, I'm only telling this to you because I want you to be better, not for any gain for myself.
Yeah. And I brought up intervention kind of, you know, as a joke, but also, I mean, there's a formula behind what they do on intervention because they know it works, is they do come from a place of empathy and a place of love. And they say like, hey, you know, I love you. I care about you. I don't want you to keep suffering from this thing. And then what they do is they set boundaries and they say like, look, if you're going to continue to do this, I can't be a part of your life in this way. And so I think it's okay. Like, it's okay to set boundaries like that and say like, hey, you know, if using addiction for an example, like if you're going to continue to use, I can't continue to support you. I can't give you any money. I can't give you rides to go pick up drugs or whatever, you know, like, so it's okay to have those boundaries. But yeah, Ed, you're absolutely right. It's got to come from a place of love and empathy.
Yeah, I have a lot of personal experience with this one. Like I alluded to before, both of my parents are mentally ill, and my father, gonna put him on blast a little bit, but whatever. He has a pretty intense bipolar disorder. He kind of goes into these episodes, and the thing that I always found so frustrating with him was that I'm not a doctor, but I think there might be a little bit of a narcissistic personality disorder in there too, which actually he fully admits now. It's hard because somebody with like that type of like personality disorder doesn't think that anything's wrong with them, mm-hmm. and doesn't want to accept it. Funny story about my dad. I remember this was actually like in the last year. My dad went on Zoloft and then after like a week stopped taking it because, now I've never heard of anybody being allergic to Zoloft. You can correct me, Justin, if that actually is a thing that happens. But I was like, yeah, my dad is allegedly allergic to Zoloft, but I just like didn't buy it. That's kind of his pattern, is like, oh, there's a reason why I can't take this medication anymore that may or may not be completely legitimate. So, but I had always done with my dad is, because he does go through these like cycles, is that when he starts going through what I call one of his like episodes, is I'm just like, I love you, but when you're ready to communicate in a better way or a more productive way, then I will respond to you. And then I just like turn off notifications for him and he'll just like go off all he wants and I won't see any of them. And then because I just won't entertain the discussion when I can tell that he's like in one of those states. And so like what you were saying about boundaries, mm-hmm. yeah, that's like a boundary that I set up and that has helped, because I'm not going to entertain, basically, I'm not going to entertain your bullshit when you're clearly not in the right state of mind. But are people ever allergic to Zoloft? I just really want to clear that up.
It's like, before we move on, we have to clarify.
I have to know.
It's possible, yes. But I mean, I would have to know what specific reaction he had to see if it's a legitimate thing. But yeah, I mean, it is possible.
Is it common?
I wouldn't say it's common.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought. Just because like my dad is allegedly allergic to a lot of medications that he really should be on. So I'm just like, so when you're dealing with a person like that, I mean, yeah, the boundaries thing.
No, I think it kind of goes back to what we teach a lot, like in our groups at the eating disorder program. There's a specific curriculum that we teach like about assertiveness and just assertive communication and like how to differ from like passive communication and aggressive communication and trying to get in that middle and being assertive. And a lot of the times what I tell the patients is like, the whole point of assertive communication is to get your point across and to explain what your needs are and to like state them very clearly while also setting boundaries. And then just kind of like leaving it in the other person's, like the ball is in their court kind of thing. Like you've explained what you needed to explain. Like you have made the points you needed to make, and you can take comfort in that and knowing that like you said what you had to say and like you were assertive, and that's just kind of it. And that's just kind of like that DBT skill, the dialectical behavioral therapy of like just radical acceptance of just, I said what I needed to say. It's a done deal. And that's what comes of it is what comes of it.
Yeah. You can't force help onto people. Mm-hmm. Whatever yeah. that platitude is about, like you can lead a horse to water or whatever, but yeah. They have to want to change. And really, like, you know, your mental health isn't your fault, but it is your responsibility. It's not anybody else's responsibility. And so only they can take those steps. And yeah, I mean, my experiences with it have been on the more extreme side, but yeah, it just comes down to like, you just have to know what's going on with them when it's happening. And like, you know, like you can't try to argue with somebody who's clearly like having a little bit of like a manic episode. Like you can't argue with that person. You just can't. Mm-hmm. So like, don't try. Like, and once you stop like entertaining it and feeding into it, they'll eventually get the picture. And so you just have to be empathetic and patient, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that concludes all of our questions.
We did it.
And definitely in record time than if it had just been Ronnie and I, we would have been sitting here for like 4 hours talking about absolute bullshit. But
I'm glad we could help.
Yeah, of course. But yeah, thank you so much for answering these questions and coming on the show. This was really fun. And so before we hop off, if you just want to plug your show again and tell people where they can find you.
Yeah. Is it okay if I do this, Justin?
Adelante, Eduardo.
Yeah, so Justin and I's podcast is called Millennial Mental Health Channel, basically because we're both of millennial age and we're both mental health professionals. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. We're on all the major sites like Spotify and Apple Podcasts, but we're also on like the other ones like Stitcher and CastBox and Google Podcasts. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram. It's the same name, at MillennialMHC. Yeah, feel free to give us a follow, like, subscribe, whatever you guys got to do. Check us out if you'd like. And we like to keep the conversation of mental health going as well, because it gets easier for other people to talk about it the more they talk about it. So thank you guys for having us. This is really cool. Justin and I were really looking forward to being on the show today.
That was our conversation with Justin and Eddie from the Millennial Mental Health Channel podcast. Please go check out their podcast and listen and subscribe and do all the things. I really enjoyed listening to their show. They are far more qualified than us. They give you real facts that they actually learned in school and not from Google like we do. So now we're going to answer the last two questions that we got from our listeners. And we saved these ones for Ronnie and I because they're the fun, not science-y or medical ones. So we're just going to hop into that. So a Gemini Taurus cusp who takes Zoloft asked us, do you think some zodiac signs are more likely to get mental health issues than others? What do you think, Ronnie?
Absolutely.
I concur.
It's not one of those like correlation equals causation. Yeah. Maybe I mixed those up.
Causation doesn't equal whatever.
Just because somebody's a Gemini doesn't mean they're all going to be like Kanye. But
it's a little bit suspicious that Kanye is who he is. And also as we're recording this, what is today? Today is Thursday, November 5th at 7:50 p.m. The former president of the United States of America, also a Gemini, also fucking out of his goddamn mind. You know, come to your own conclusions with what that means.
But in the vein of other signs, Pisces are known to want to live in a realm of fantasy. And so they're also more likely to like be not druggies, but like druggies or like hippies, I guess.
Two famous Pisces, Eileen Wuornos, who if you know anything about true crime, you know who that is, but she was something. And then Kurt Cobain was also a Pisces and clearly had some severe mental health issues and some substance use disorder and was a very tortured soul. You know, I feel like it's a chicken or the egg, right? Is it your personality that leads to you potentially developing certain mental disorders, or is it your mental disorders that kind of change your personality in a certain way? I would say a lot of my personality traits are from my different mental illnesses. For instance, I'm an Aries moon, and your moon sign, if you are unaware, is the way that you process emotions. It's your inner self. It's kind of your inner monologue is sort of based in your moon on your birth chart. Mine is in Aries. I also have aggressive ADHD. You tell me, dog. Like when I read the descriptions of like a lunar Aries, I'm always like, this sounds verbatim like the definition of ADHD. There are some interesting coincidences out there in the ether.
Absolutely.
I mean, like I mentioned in this episode briefly about my dad potentially having a narcissistic personality disorder, I should also mention that he is a Capricorn. I mean, come on. Not to say that Capricorns are all narcissistic, but if you've ever met a Capricorn, it also wouldn't surprise you, right?
Which that's another thing too. We all have our flaws that I think, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I'm gonna say it because it sounds kind of good. We all have our flaws that if left unchecked could become something
that's very true, yeah,
mentally taxing on you and for other people as well.
Yeah, that's a possibly very good point. I've read in some like astrology books about like, this is what a low functioning Aquarius is like, and this is what a high functioning Aquarius is like. The duality of the low and high functioning zodiac sign, it's kind of like, yeah, at your worst, certain zodiac signs are going to act this way. And yeah, so those different like personality flaws when you're low functioning, yeah, like might manifest into some kind of like diagnosable thing. So I love this question. It really does like make me think. I don't know, I could see it being a really fun like pop astrology meme of like the signs as mental disorders. A Gemini Taurus cusp asked this, and I just want to say, despite what I said about Donald Trump and Kanye West, I love Geminis. I adore them. I've had my heart broken by many a Gemini, and Geminis are just so fucking smart. And sometimes I think being really intelligent, you know, it makes you a little bit crazy, right? Because you're just so, I don't know. I feel like, Ronnie, what do you think about this? Like really intelligent people tending to be more, I don't know, to be more mentally ill?
Yes, I don't know. I'm gonna be honest. I read something that said the funniest people are often the most mentally ill, and everyone was like, ha 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 ha, and in that thread. And I was like, all right, we can't all be funny.
Yeah.
You know, so we can't all be like geniuses.
Yeah, yeah.
We can't all be as like mentally ill as the next person.
Right.
But
right, because Donald Trump is a Gemini, but he's a fucking idiot. But he's also definitely like severely mentally ill.
The mild form of that would be like his rhetoric is really good, you know, like his ability to speak and say things in a way that conveys, like he can honestly like just say things, and like if you don't really listen to what he's saying, he's not like dumb, you
yeah
know? If that makes sense, like he's good at manipulating people, and so like that's like a Gemini thing, so that doesn't have any bearing on like intelligence.
That's true,
in like a way of like strict intelligence, but like, you know, there's like different
yeah
ways.
I think more so a better way to put that would have just been like the way that Geminis are good at communicating, and people who are good at communicating are also better at being manipulative. I mean, DJT just like stands up and tells blatant lies and people fucking believe it. It's wild. And I say that as he's currently throwing a fit over election results right now and claiming that there's fraud going on, when lest we forget, didn't you like steal the last election and that's how you became anyway, I don't want to talk about that, but I think that certain personality traits are tied to your mental illness or disorder or whatever, and then certain ones just like manifest into different disorders. But I don't know, it's a really interesting thing to think about, so I love this question.
Everybody's annoying.
Everybody is annoying in their own special, beautiful way. And then lastly, we were asked, what inspired you to start the podcast? All right, so we touched a little bit on this in this episode about the way that people talk about mental health online, specifically with self-care, but what really was kind of the catalyst? Well, there were multiple things. I've talked about before being a drug-addled youth in my day, and in hindsight, it's a little funny, and like I would always make jokes about it, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that I have ADHD and I have no filter, and I'll say literally anything. And sometimes I say things just to say them. I think there was like a lack of raw honesty in mental health discourse. I think people sugarcoat it a lot. And then I also think people don't have enough of a sense of humor about themselves or take themselves a little bit too seriously. You know, you can talk about mental health without it being a fucking ASPCA commercial with Sarah McLachlan music playing in the background. You're allowed to laugh at yourself and you're allowed to laugh at your experience, even if it's like really dark. And I wanted a space to just kind of poke fun at myself and ourselves. And also, this is an anecdote that comes up a lot when I think about this. When Ronnie and I worked for the company that shall not be named, I was getting a ride home from our supervisor at the time. And I will preface this by saying I did not like this supervisor. I was a little bit of a bulldog towards him. So this wasn't somebody that I was like close with in any way. And he was driving me home from the office one afternoon. We were sitting in traffic and he asks me, or he says to me, I think my brother might be depressed. How should I approach helping him get help? Because I'm really concerned about him. And this was really weird because, again, this is somebody who I'm not close with. This is somebody who I never have like, you know, real honest conversations with, and this isn't someone that I particularly like. And I kind of gave him the spiel that I always give, which is like, well, when you approach him about it, you need to come at it from like an empathetic standpoint, and all you can really do is give him the resources and it's ultimately up to him. But if you're very concerned about him, you know, you need to make sure that it's like an ongoing conversation and you check in with him regularly, especially if he's not getting help, whatever. I gave him the whole thing. And then I was like, why did you ask me that? And he said, well, you're always so upfront and like brutally honest with the fact that you have depression. So I felt like you were a good person to talk to about this. And that kind of was like an epiphany for me because I realized that there was something there, like there was power in talking about it, even if it's just like jokes. Because like the way that I talk about like my mental illnesses to people, like in real life, it's like, it's always jokes because that's my coping mechanism, right? As I make a lot of jokes. And even that was something that made him feel comfortable enough to come to me with a very like personal problem that he was having. I don't know. That was a really powerful experience. And it made me realize that there was something here. I had already had the idea for this and it was just kind of cooking in my mind at the time. But that really solidified for me the possibilities in talking about mental health, even if it's not in a super serious, always super well-researched way. Just being open and honest about what it's actually like and being upfront with people about what you experience is a powerful thing that helps other people around you. Beyond that, I've had people in workplaces ask me things like, hey, how did you find your therapist? Or, hey, you mentioned that you've been on this medication before. My doctor wants to prescribe me that. Like, what do you think? Like, people that are literally like coworkers that I don't have like a super personal relationship with, but because I became so open and honest about it, they felt like I was a safe person to come to with that kind of stuff. And I think that if more people were like that, I think more people would be comfortable about talking about things or asking questions and seeking out the help that they frankly need.
Yeah, and I came along for the ride because I got whack brain chemistry as well.
Ronnie, for whatever reason, agreed to do this ridiculous bullshit with me, and we're happy to have him. And he's a crowd favorite.
I find that hard to believe, but yes.
Oh no, lots of people have told me that they love you. What I think is super funny is when somebody will message me and say, I love the podcast. You and Ronnie are so great. Ronnie is so smart and well-spoken, and you're like really honest.
They know I'm black. No, I'm kidding. But seriously.
But like, are we kidding? No, but like, I always think it's really funny when people are like, oh yeah, I love Ronnie so much. He's so smart. He's so well-spoken. And you're just like really blunt. Like, that's my favorite thing that people say. But with all of that said, this is the actual end of the podcast. Thanks again to Justin and Eddie for coming on this episode. We hope that you enjoyed. And we also, I think we would like to do more episodes like this in the future where we answer your questions. It was really fun. So if you want to be in the know for the next time we ask for questions, the best thing you can do is follow us on Instagram, Pretty Girl Pill Club. And that way you'll always be up to date. And when we're taking questions, you'll be able to participate in that. And also you can always send us DMs on social media or send us emails if there's something that you have a question about that you would like us to look into, or just a topic you would like to hear us talk about. Our DMs and our email is always open to you. But with all of that said, this has been the Pretty Girl Pill Club. Go and check out Millennial Mental Health channel and take your meds, drink some water, and we'll talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.